you know, there's something very sad about, we see that, of course, with Jacob's wives as well, the kind of rivalry that they have for his affection and who can bear a child. And so in that sense, even though there's a lot of really interesting things that Leah and Rachel are doing, there's still a lot of sadness to the right. system that pits them against one another, and they're fighting for favor based on their ability to give birth or not.
The Bible is full of stories that we all know and love. But how well do we know them? The answer might surprise you. The Bible you thought you knew is going to dive deep into the exquisite details of the biblical stories that make them fascinating and transforming. In this week's broadcast, I'm going to have a couple of guests. These are people with whom I have been colleagues. They are also dear friends. I'm going to give you their names, and then I'm going to have them introduce themselves. And we're going to be discussing today mostly the women in the Exodus, but also some other women in the Old Testament. And this will be fun. And you get to hear somebody besides me in this podcast. So my two friends, these are both Old Testament scholars, are Karen Winslow and Sarah Koenig. And I'm going to have them start with Karen to introduce yourself, and then we'll go to Sarah. Go ahead, Karen.
All right. Well, now I'm at Azusa Pacific University, the seminary, which is embedded in the university, and I'm a professor of biblical studies. I chair the Department of Biblical and Theological Studies, and I direct the Masters of Arts in Theological Studies program. But I was also at Greenville University for 3 years, and before that at Seattle Pacific for 12 years, and I remember Sarah as a student, and couldn't be more thrilled that she's at SPU now. My dissertation that was turned into a book is on Moses' wives, so Zipporah of Exodus and the Cushite wife of Moses, whose story is told in Numbers. And it was a lengthy process, and I got to include many things that connect to the Zipporah story, like circumcision and celibacy and the construction of ethnicity by text, as well as social practice. And then later on, I wrote commentaries on Esther, the women in Isaiah. Those are separate publishing houses. And then I was part of the Global Theological Dictionary, Wesleyan Dictionary, published by the Nazarenes. And then later they did one on biblical theology, the Global Biblical Wesleyan Dictionary. And I wrote on women, different women in the Bible for that, and women in the church and history in general. So recently, I published a book called Imagining Equity that is based on lectures and essays that I wrote for my Seattle Pacific class that we called Women in the Christian Tradition, but it's morphed over the years as I've taught it everywhere that I've taught. And so it's a recent book, it's only 115 pages, Imagining Equity, The Gifts of Christian Feminist Theology. So, of course, I talk about women in the Bible in that book, but I go on to talk about feminist theology as well. And then right now I'm working on a book called Daughters and Fathers of the Bible.
Okay. Thanks, Karen. We'll get back to you. Sarah, go ahead. Introduce yourself.
Yes. As Karen said, I am a product of SPU in many ways. I was a student of Karen's when I was an undergraduate student at SPU, and then I went away to Princeton Seminary for my master's and my PhD, and then got to come back to the place that I was shaped and formed to teach here. So I'm a professor of biblical studies here at Seattle Pacific University and seminary. My dissertation was on Bathsheba, because I was so interested in how there's very little about her in the text. You know, as Frank has talked about, these details in these wonderful details in the biblical narrative, there's actually not, sometimes it's a sparsity of the text which draws you in. And Bathsheba is one of those for me, that there's so little written about her, and yet people had such varying interpretations of her. So that was my dissertation, which got turned into a book on her character. And then I followed that up with my second book is on her reception history. So how she's been received over the centuries, from everything from VeggieTales to the sermons of Luther and Calvin. So it's been an interesting project. I'm still working in reception history, but I feel like I might have finished with Bathsheba, at least for now.
Okay. Well, thank you. We'll come back to these issues. because Zipporah is one of the ones that I treated in the my Women in the Exodus podcast. So let's go to that and just think about that a little bit. First of all, give me your general impressions about that particular podcast.
Well, of course, I loved it and agreed with you about how shrewd and full of wits the women in the story were compared to the men in the story.
I figured you'd like that a lot.
Especially Pharaoh. I want to be fair to Pharaoh in that he went after male babies because he was so afraid that they would grow up into warriors, even though all of that was a ridiculous idea. But yeah, you were right about if you really wanted to hurt the Hebrews, he should have gone after girls. But I'm glad he didn't, because look at how they saved Moses. The great deliverer, the great savior, the great servant of the Lord. There's the quintessential prophet. You know, he's saved by all these women, including his wife, Zipporah.
Indeed. Go ahead, Sarah.
I agree. I loved it. I like not only the contrast between the midwives and Pharaoh, but then also all these women and Moses, who seems less creative. He just responds with violence, which I would argue is not the most creative response when you're faced with injustice. And then also how you traced all these women throughout his story that, as Karen just said, without these women, we'd have no Moses. You know, his life was threatened so many times in so many situations, and in each time he was saved by a woman. So it reminds me a little bit of when people refer to Mary Magdalene as the apostle to the apostles. And without her telling the disciples she's seen the Lord in John's gospel, we wouldn't have a witness to the resurrection. And similar, we wouldn't have the deliverer, Moses, had he not been delivered and saved by so many women in his early life and in his later life as well with Zipporah.
Yeah, and I puzzled with whether or not to attribute as much intention as I did. But here's what made me think that the contrast was so stark with Moses in the violent episode that Sarah just mentioned. And that is when he, the next day, the corpse has already been found. So he buried the evidence very, very poorly. I used to tell my students, here's a foot sticking out, here's an arm sticking out. And when he tries to arbitrate the quarrel between the two Hebrews, he says, they must know. Well, they just now mentioned that you killed him. And I thought that was so intentional on the part of the so-called implied narrator. You wouldn't just say that as incidental. And of course, I don't think anything is incidental in the biblical text, because these stories have been so well crafted. And so I thought the narrative itself invited the contrast between how very clumsy he was and how very rash he was, and compared to how clever Moses' mother and sister were, how clever the two midwives were, and then Zipporah, not so much clever as much as quick thinking. But all of those are hardly accidental, it seems to me.
Yeah, and they're insiders and outsider women. You couldn't get more in than the Levite family, the sister, the mother. But then you have the outsider, Pharaoh's daughter. I mean, you can see Israelites sitting around telling each other these stories and laughing over time and performing them over time. And how ridiculous it is that Pharaoh's own daughter is a savior of Moses. You know, she's an ultimate outsider. Zipporah is too.
Sure.
Daughter of a priest of Midian. And then her own father, Jethro, he's another great outsider who has a wonderful faith confession. Pharaoh doesn't get it. He doesn't know the Lord. He refuses to know the Lord, the new God on the block. But Jethro, the outside Midianite, when he hears the wonderful works of the Lord, perhaps through Zipporah, probably, he confesses great faith, the signs and wonders worked on him, just like they worked on Rahab in the Joshua story.
Yeah, yeah. Sarah, did you have anything to say? Yeah.
I was a little bit curious about your treatment of Pharaoh's daughter, because I read something recently about her that was just talking about how subversive her actions were against her father.
Yes.
Which I think you touched on a little bit, where Pharaoh is painted less in less wonderful terms in this narrative than he could have been. It's not the glorious picture of a pharaoh. And there's something about his own daughter going against him. And you talked a lot about her maternal compassion, the pity that she feels. I wonder if there's something more to the story than that on her part. And this is part of the reception history, which kind of digs in more to what the text doesn't say. And I very much want to respect the gaps in the text, what it doesn't talk about. But I've wondered about her motives beyond just her compassion. Or maybe that's enough. Maybe feeling pity for this poor, vulnerable child would be enough. But it seems like there could be something more there to why she does this. Have you two thought about that?
Well, you know, that's an intriguing thought, because in that sense, you would say she was being subversive against Egyptian patriarchy and not just patriarchal in general. And so she's saying, you know, my dad has this terrible edict. If I was a good daughter, I'd just simply dump the basket and let this baby go. But it's striking to me that the baby cries. That's what turns it around. And she doesn't react then by her political instincts, but on some other bases. But you might be right, Sarah, that there may be something going on that all you can do, of course, is speculate. But if the text itself invites the speculation, you can at least say, well, maybe she's seeing something there about in terms of her own world and her own culture and her own father's abuse of power and so forth. And so I think that's a very interesting point. I really did not exploit it as much as I might have in the podcast, but that's a great point. Yeah.
Well, I love to speculate along that line as well, because she might not have had any desire to support her father for any reason. And this is where I think the receivers of the text, Jews, would particularly enjoy this part of the story, where she has no qualms about, like the midwives who had no qualms, she's like them, disobeying the edicts of Pharaoh. She's going to preserve life. And this is the theme of Genesis, where the good people like Tamar, however they happen to do it, are the preservers of life. And here is Pharaoh's daughter joining all the other relatives of Moses preserving life.
Yeah, quite so. And, you know, I guess it occurs to me now that we're thinking about this, is that the way the narrative tells the story, and as we say, it invites us to think about this, so that in some sense, you could argue that Pharaoh's daughter is already on a kind of personal transformation, even though no reasons are given. And the very fact that she would bring this baby into the court. You know, of course, Hollywood has made much of this where, you know, next thing you know, Moses is with Pharaoh and talking with other sons of Pharaoh and so forth, and finally goes away, because Hollywood has no limits to its imagination and what it does. But it's not just that she saves this baby, but she rears it as her own child and until his adulthood. And we're allowed to speculate, how in the world did he ever know that he was Hebrew? How did he ever know that the Israelites were his people? He had to get that from somewhere, because he's in a basket. He's 3 months old. He would have no recollection of that. He wouldn't know his own language. He would speak only Egyptian. All of that is wondrously ambiguated in the text, because it allows us to say, well, what in the world's going on? And again, that allows the Hollywood producers and the Hollywood directors to spin the story out any way they want. But that's a very, very good point on that. And
yeah, another new book for you, Sarah, Trace the Reception History Among the Jews. Like, that's what I did in the Zipporah story and the Cushite wife. And it's fun. It's interesting. It's great. My students have trouble when I bring that in. Assuming that, okay, now we have the rock bottom truth. You know, if the Jews said it before zero, then that's the true insight. And no, they're having fun. I mean, they're not just having fun. They're having serious questions and answers. But I'd love to see what the Midrash on that is. I didn't love what all they did with Zipporah, because some of them wrote her out of the story completely.
The Midrash has a tendency to do those kinds of things. And the other thing is, in terms of the gapping that Sarah brought up, It's never clear. I've never heard a good explanation as to why, after 3 months, Moses' mother thinks that she can't hide him anymore. What's the difference between a 3 month and a 4 month? That is never stated.
And well, I know. He's chubby. He's getting chubby. And loud. I mean, I have a 3 month old grandson, and he's a big old boy now. I think he's just too big and too loud.
Okay. All right.
That there's a book I read when I was pregnant that talked about newborns and how there's what you call the fourth trimester. So, you know, a woman's pregnant for 9 months, three trimesters, and they said from 0 to 3 months, it's almost like a fourth trimester, that there's so much development that happens. But in those early months, up to 3 months, they still don't do a whole lot. They're pretty, relatively to after 3 months, they're quiet. They don't move as much. So there may be something about that biological reality that the text is hinting to, the 3 month specification.
Oh, well, yes. Of course, I'm going to defer to you two guys there. That's an area in which I know nothing. But then the other thing about having the sister to hang around the shore there by the Nile, and you know, that raises all kinds of things. Well, what's she going to do if somebody comes? Her age is not specified. I'm thinking of my top of my head. I don't think she's called a Nu'ara there. I think she's just Moses' sister. There's no age. I've always thought of her as a 12-year-old or a 14-year-old, something like that. But she also speaks on her feet. She's very quick on her feet, because when she sees the Pharaoh's daughter, she said, well, you know, I can find a wet nurse for her. And then, of course, the Pharaoh's daughter ends up paying Moses' mother to nurse him, which she would have kind of done in any case. So there's all this story can go on and on and on, way too long for a podcast, actually.
Well, I wondered too, and I don't think this is my own idea. Did, you know, she puts the child into the reeds and the daughter comes to bathe there. Did the mother know that that's where the daughter bathes, you know, the Pharaoh's daughter bathes, so that she put the ark in a place where it would likely be discovered? I mean, what was she thinking to put her child into the river, beyond the sort of fun irony that Pharaoh commanded people to throw the child into the river, and she did throw her male child into the river just in a protected basket. But did they know that that was where Pharaoh's daughter often would come to bathe, and did they sort of suspect that he would be found and taken care of?
Well, that's a delicious idea too, because again, very often what you and I would call coincidence, biblically speaking, is not coincidence, but it's providence. I mean, this is very much in the Joseph story, where, you know, Moses or Joseph has these dreams. We're not told that they're from God. Everyone's going to bow down to him. Well, he ends up bowing down to everybody until the middle of the story, until he really remembers his dreams. And of course, that providence ends up being articulated by Joseph, who says, well, yes, you meant it for evil, but God meant it for good. And God sent me before you to preserve life. So I think that's a great idea, Sarah. Again, and that is a piece of speculation that the text itself invites us to think about. Had Moses' mother seen Pharaoh's daughter bathe right there and said, well, let's put him there just in case. Who knows what will happen if he is found by a woman rather than by a man? And there again, you would be part of this wonderful subversion of patriarchy that goes on all over the Old Testament, it seems to me. I mean, the more you argue that it is a patriarchal culture, which it was, and patriarchs wrote this, but they subverted their own patriarchy with these incredible stories about women or girls. Yeah.
That's actually what I think here is the mother literally obeyed the edict of Pharaoh by putting her son in the river. And then, but she uses an ark, just like Noah's ark, the same word, tibah, to preserve him. So again, that theme of preserving life, but it's very, very risky on her part and on the sister's part who, like you say, what if a man, a warrior, or any Egyptian had come along instead? So I think there's some, you know, reading into the story, I think there's some insight here on the part of both the mother and the sister there.
Yeah, I think so too. And that's the fun thing about doing this with you two, because when I'm alone with my own thoughts, my imagination is not sufficiently piqued, and I get great ideas now from these conversations. Of course, I so miss the lunchroom and the third floor of Alexander, Sarah, that we used to have at lunch at, because that's where you get your ideas fertilized often. Just for a minute, let's go away from there. Can you think of some other places where you think stories of women in the Old Testament subvert the patriarchy, the patriarchal culture that produced these texts?
Definitely, yes. Yeah. One thing that comes to mind that I think fewer people know about is the story of Rizpah at the end of 2 Samuel. Mm-hmm. And it's a very tragic story where she's related to the house of Saul, and toward the end of David's life, he's kind of cleaning up Saul's dynasty, and he has all of these male descendants of Saul killed, and then their bodies are not properly taken care of. And Rizpah, who is the mother of so many of these killed boys, goes out and mourns over their bodies and protects them from the wild animals. And when David is told what she's done, he realizes how wrong his actions were, and he gives him a proper burial. And it's something about, it's not a very happy story. It's not one that you get taught in Sunday school, but it's one of those that talks about how her actions, her righteous actions, convict the king of his wrongdoing. And of course, that's happened previously for David as well, but that's one that fewer people know about. So I like to talk about Rizpah when I can.
Oh, that's a great story. Great idea. Go ahead, Karen. You were.
Well, the other one is Sarah's woman, Bathsheba. And here's another connection with the two of you. I sat in faithfully on a former prophets class that Frank taught while I was teaching with him there at SBU. And for that class, I wrote a paper on Bathsheba, the feeble gird on strength. It's a line from Hannah's song, who's another subversive woman, a subversive of patriarchy. But my point of that paper, which was turned into a chapter in a Festschrift for Paul Livermore, was about how she subverted in order to save her own life and with the help of Nathan. So the cooperative partnership there is good too, but she subverted this whole succession routine and probably made it up saying, you remember, David, you told me when we were lying in bed that night, you told me that my son Solomon would be king. And, you know, you do sort of owe that to me given the circumstances, you know. And so I love imagining all that and how she insists to the sense, you know, David, that she and her son would need to be uplifted in this way. And he goes, okay, sure, whatever, that's fine.
Oh, yeah, that's I've often thought that that was wonderfully manipulative on her part, just to show that women can sometimes be just like men in some ways. But also, you're quite right, because David, at the beginning of 2 Kings, which is where this happens, is completely out of it. I mean, remember right. How the King James puts it, that he got no heat. I mean, he's so out of it, he doesn't even say anything until he has Bathsheba come to him. And you're right, it's never in the text that he ever said that Solomon would be his successor. And Adonijah was the elder son at that point. But Nathan was not, he was complicitous in this too. But you're quite right. And again, that's another subversion. Now, that may be not quite as flattering in terms of what they're trying to do, but it does show the subversion of patriarchy.
Well, and it saved her life. I mean, given what happened to Adonijah and given what seemed to be the custom around them and also among them, Israel, she and her son would be counted as offenders if Adonijah became king. And so there you go.
Yeah, yeah.
And I even suspect, and I think both of you have probably written on this, I suspect that she had a sort of tongue-in-cheek attitude when she went to Solomon to say, can your older brother Adonijah have Abishag as a wife? I mean, you know, he lost a king. Can't he please? And he's incensed and has Adonijah killed. But it isn't, she isn't necessarily innocent in that.
Oh, you know, no, I think you're quite right. And I have written on that. It's a way to say, I mean, she says, I know my son. And of course, in that whole story, at first, Adonijah does not invite Solomon and Bathsheba to the banquet. And so already he has already gone in that direction, and they return the favor. And once Solomon gets power, it's all but over. And the point here is that throughout the biblical material, you have this subversion. And I guess I've argued that in a slightly different way in the woman at the well story in John 4, because that woman gave as well as she took. She took on Jesus in a way that many other male characters did not. In fact, Nicodemus, in the very previous interview in John 3, Nicodemus doesn't do, and he's a ruler in Israel, he doesn't do nearly as well as the woman at the well who is never named. And she knows what she's doing. And then again, that's another subversion of the patriarchy. And I guess part of what I'm interested in thinking is, how did these, I mean, almost surely this was written by men. Mm-hmm. How did they get this? How did they figure this out? How did they realize that we are part of a patriarchal system, but there's something wrong with that? There's something, we need to tell these stories that upset that order of things, that, those arrangements. And I don't have a good answer for that.
This is actually the point of my daughter and father's book, because I'm going to spend a lot of time in Judges with Jephthah's daughter and the Levite's concubine. The stories both subvert what's going on in Judges, of course. But I think all the stories we've mentioned and more do that. And I think there's so many things going on. You know, you all talk about the multivalent, multilayered aspects of the text. So I think there's patriarchy, and then there's a subversion of patriarchy, but I think there's some hints of subverting the subversion too. Of course, it depends on the interpreter's stance, but I'm still, you know, a champion of Eve, and you know, she's Isha, and then she only becomes life after God shows them mercy and exiles them from the garden, but she's the mother of all the living. And so there's subversion there, but still, the fact that the storyteller has her coming out of the man, even though the man's dead asleep and has nothing to do with it, he does sort of, in a way, give birth to a woman. So, you know, I want to problematize even our subversion.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, that's fine.
Even for how, I'll continue with this word, subversion, even the fact that the women do play a role here, the larger culture is very patriarchal, and often it's very tragic what happens to them. I mean, Karen, your mention of Jephthah's daughter, it's a terrible story. The Levite's concubine, I think, how can we not feel horrified of what happens to these women? And so even if we want to say, look at how powerful their story is, and that it makes us realize how wrong patriarchy is, it's also at a terrible cost to them in the story. So I wouldn't want to minimize the fact that it's hard for women in biblical times.
Right.
No, quite so. Quite.
And yeah, just to get a story out of this, you know, they give their lives. Yeah.
Yeah. Or even the other person who came to mind immediately when you said subversive of patriarchy was Sarai in Genesis 16, when Abram just basically does everything that she tells him to do. And so, you know, who really has the authority there? She says, Abram, go sleep with my servant Hagar. And he says very little. And then she gets mad at Hagar and says, now send her away. You know, and so the way that she has all this authority in their relationship. And yet there's something really tragic about that story that has to do with their worth being seen as women and whether or not they can bear a child. And, right. You know, there's something very sad about, we see that, of course, with Jacob's wives as well, the kind of rivalry that they have for his affection in who can bear a child. And so in that sense, even though there's a lot of really interesting things that Leah and Rachel are doing, there's still a lot of sadness to the right. System that hits them against one another and they're fighting for favor based on their ability to give birth or not.
Well, yeah, and there's Leia who can give birth, but what she wants is Jacob's love. Rachel has Jacob's love, but not children. Yeah. They want what the other person has, and so they're such rivals in the story. And you're right about Sarah and Hagar. It's so tragic all the way around. An abusive woman, you know, and abusive to her maidservant who they probably took out of Egypt as it is. And yet God kept affirming that the son of promise had to come to Sarah. But I even question, this is actually a new thought because we just taught it recently and my students were so troubled by how Hagar was treated and even Sarah. So even though Sarah, you know, should know better, but I think Ishmael is a wonderful product of that. And so, you know, how great it is that we have an Ishmael, you know, and the way I grew up, the story was, oh, if only Ishmael hadn't been born, there'd be no problem. You know, this is Sunday school and none of that is true anyway. But anyway, I'm starting to really appreciate, even though it was messy and showed lack of faith on Sarah's part, you end up with a wonderful young man and all of his descendants.
Well, and isn't this the case throughout the biblical material that God works in all this mess? Yeah. I mean, it's not a smooth story. If you, again, as I said so many times, if you were going to make a story to make the protagonist look good, this was a complete disaster because no one looks good. Sarah doesn't look good. Abraham doesn't look good. Hagar looks good. What she could do. I mean, she was completely, she had no choice, in it, so to speak. And even the two other hand wives or the handmaidens to Leah and Rachel, they didn't have any choice. The two sisters were rivals, but these two women had no choice whatsoever. And so I think Sarah's point that we have to be careful not to soften the sadness of the sort of reality behind the text that produces. At the same time, there's probably no period in history where God would not have to work through messes. We have our messes in the modern world. We have the messes in the medieval world. The messes in the you can't name an era where God would able to say, well, this is a good time for me to do something because people are so broken. We are so troubled. We are so compromised. We are so self-centered.
Mixed motives.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think, and again, that makes me still so very fascinated about these stories, especially when you drill into the details. And that's what I'm trying to do in these podcasts. So any final thoughts?
Well, I just wanted to hear a little bit more about all of Karen's work with Zipporah, you know, and just your response to what Frank said about her specifically. How did she know what to do?
Go ahead. Do that. Great.
Well, it's such a cryptic story. And every scholar who either doesn't write on it or does begins by saying, you know, either glosses over it, moves on, or then writes more, says it's a cryptic story and it's enigmatic. And we don't know what it means. So that's why I chose it. I wanted to, here she is an outsider. Here she is a woman. She does something fabulous. She's one of three named circumcisers in the Bible. The other one is Abraham and the other one is Joshua. And she functions as a mohelet. And she is
the Hebrew word for a circumciser.
And she links the Abrahamic covenant of circumcision, the sign of the covenant, to the Mosaic covenant ultimately. And her throwing the bloody foreskin at Moses' genitals is so similar to putting the blood on the door. I mean, the same word is used exactly, the verb and the blood. And then she affirms herself as a relation of blood, a legal relation of blood. So they put bridegroom in some of our translations, but that isn't the best word. Husband's okay because that's what a legal relation is between a husband and a wife. But it's the same word as it's hatan, which is the same as the relationship between Moses and Jethro. I mean, they put the verbs in hoten, but you know they're not in the text. And brother-in-law. So she is the legal relation to Moses through this circumcision, and then she calls herself of blood. So instead of just being a pawn or like the meal or like the item of exchange to tie Pharaoh and Moses together, she herself claims to be the legal relation of blood, like a covenant, like Barit and Korat and to Moses. And so, and then the editor, you know, the producer or the narrator affirms that and repeats it. So that's why I think it's short, but it's so powerful. And of course, it doesn't say how she knew what to do, but clearly she did know what to do, and clearly it worked.
And it had to be very fast because the Lord was right on his tail. He was ready to come.
Yeah. And of course, the Septuagint doesn't like that. It makes it an angel of the Lord. And some of the others pick up on that. But there actually ends up being in the reception history an atoning quality to this function, atoning for presumed sin of Moses. And again, this is where the Midrash comes in, and they assume that the problem and the reason the Lord tried to kill him, because that's one of those huge gaps that you mentioned, like, why? They say, well, he didn't circumcise one of his sons, and Jethro made him promise he wouldn't do one of them. He could do one for the sake of Yahweh, but he couldn't do the other one for the sake of the Midianites. And so on the way, you know, the Lord insisted, which, you know, it's a nice idea because it worked. And so, yeah, I mean, I do get kind of wrapped up in the Torah.
Hey, thank you. Did that scratch your itch, Sarah?
It did. But as you said, there's so much more than we can even cover in this podcast, even just about the women in Exodus.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you asked, and what I was going to say, Frank, is your very question about writers, producers, preservers of the text over time kept these stories in, these subversives of patriarchy stories, and they were men. But I don't think we automatically need to assume they were themselves. I mean, they could have been, but maybe not so patriarchal the way we define it today. I mean, so that's why I want to explore that question more, you know, when we're done, and it really helps to talk these things together. Because, well, there is, you know, the factor of inspiration and perhaps the Holy Spirit saying, maybe this isn't what you want to say, but this is what I want you to say. You know, I don't. or in their own honesty of telling the stories, in their own honesty of wanting to preserve. You know, at any time they could have cut them out if they were true patriarchs and wanted to only emphasize them, like the interpreters have done, they could have cut them out, and they didn't.
Well, you're right. I guess I'll make an appeal here to the fiddler on the roof thing. Christians very often talk about the Old Testament God as so unapproachable and so judgmental, but Tevye's relationship with God is something that Christians would never do. You know, he complains that the horse is lame today, or how come I only have five daughters and not one single son, and all of that. And so that's an interesting relationship to God, where you're not afraid to sort of take God to task. And I think something that you said here, it's not so much that these guys are closet feminists and sort of sneaking these stories in, but rather that the tradition is so rich, the thinking is so fermenting, it's so yeasty, there's so much going on that they were able to say, you know, we have to hold on to this. We're not even sure what it means. I'm guessing there was more than one Israelite man who thought of himself as the head of the house, who was listening to his wife all the time and obeying the wife all the time. So, I mean, in that sense, there's patriarchy in terms of its theory, and there's patriarchy in its practice, and those two may not be the same thing. So it is interesting. I think you're right, Karen, that I don't want to attribute too much self-consciousness to these stories. But at some point, when you put them together, I mean, when you think of Ezra and Nehemiah and how ethnocentric it is, and then you compare that to Jonah and all of Nineveh comes in, somebody had to notice this. That's too stark. That's too strong of a separation. Where you say, how did this get past the editors, so to speak? So, well, we have to have another conversation about this because this was very, very good. I want to thank both Karen Winslow and Sarah Koenig for coming on to this podcast. We might have them on again with other topics. And for this time, we'll come again and talk about what I've been calling from the beginning of this podcast, dealing with Jesus' own personal Bible, which Christians call the Old Testament. God bless.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you.
I want to thank you so very much for listening to The Bible You Thought You Knew. I have a question for you. Do you have a question or topic that you'd like me to cover on the podcast? If so, all you need to do is head over to Apple Podcasts and do two simple things. One, leave a rating and review telling me what you think of the podcast. Two, in that review, ask anything you want related to the Bible. That's all you have to do. Then, listen in to hear your question answered on a future episode. Join us next time on The Bible You Thought You Knew when we discuss Jesus' personal Bible. God bless.